On this episode of Complicated Conversations, we welcome back Joe Piazza. Joe is the international best-selling author of 12 books, including the Good Morning America book club pick, We Are Not Like Them, with Christine Pride. She's also the host of the critically acclaimed Under the Influence podcast. Her work has been featured in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, among other publications. She lives in Philadelphia with her husband and three feral children. Her new novel, The Sicilian Inheritance, is out now. Welcome back to Pop Fiction Women, Joe.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I love talking to you, too. This is one of my favorite podcasts to be on. And I'm on about 50 to promote this book.
And your own podcast.
So. And it's your third time back. So we obviously love having you as well.
I'm going to keep coming. Keep coming, guys.
Good.
We'll love it. So why don't you start by telling our listeners the elevator pitch for The Sicilian Inheritance and maybe a little bit about the personal inspiration, which you note in your author's note. And everyone knows if they're following you, which you should be, because her Instagram is so great. But
Thank you.
Good. Yeah. So entertaining.
So The Sicilian Inheritance is a novel, and it's the best book that I've ever written. It really is. And I've written 12 at this point. It is loosely based on the murder of my own great-great-grandmother, Lorenza Marsala, in Sicily. It's a family murder mystery. It's a little historical fiction, a little thriller. I mean, really, it's just an adventure. It's about badass women going on an adventure in Sicily with delicious food and delicious wine and like hunky men and some like not so gross sex. And it's the best book, I think, to get you out of a reading slump. A lot of people have told me that they're like, you know what? This book was just joy. And I felt joyful. And then I felt all the emotions and I cried at the end. And I wanted to create something that people could just feel really good about. And I think The Sicilian Inheritance is that. I'm hoping it's going to be the book of the summer.
Yes.
And as I said, it's loosely based on my own great-great-grandmother's murder in Sicily. She was killed in 1916. My family has passed down this story for generations, although because they're Italian Americans, we are myth makers and storytellers and essentially liars. And so I didn't know if any of it was true. And I just wanted to write a novel about a woman who was left alone in Sicily and how dangerous that might be. And also how freeing to not be a wife, to not be a mother, to get to have a job for the first time. And we have a modern day woman who goes back and solves this mystery. And she's from Philly, by the way. So this is also, it's the most Philly book I've ever written, but it's set in Sicily. So it's like Philly and Sicily. I'm trying to get it to be the like one book, one Philly thing. And they're like, really? And I'm like, yeah, no, really. Yeah. This is what Philadelphia wants to read.
Love it.
So after I wrote the book, I didn't want to know the real story. I just wanted that nugget because I wanted to write fiction. But because I'm a psychopath and I'm a very thorough content creator, after I wrote the book, I decided to go solve the murder mystery in real life.
Love
with
that.
A podcast, a true crime podcast, also called The Sicilian Inheritance, where I literally go to Sicily to solve the murder of my great-great-grandmother. I took my three kids under the age of 7 last summer to Sicily to solve this murder, and then I just got back on Sunday night as I'm speaking to you. We were supposed to talk when I landed in Sicily, and I'm like, I can't. I just can't. I went back to go through the homicide records and the mafia records.
And they didn't let you do that, or there was like a timing issue with that, right? They were just open to you? Yeah.
I've been applying for it for a year.
Like, oh, wow.
Italian bureaucracy is no joke.
Wow.
And so they didn't want to let me in. I had to write all of these letters. We could get into the normal criminal records, but those don't have any homicide. And there's an entire special section for mafia records. But once I got in, they were so nice. So I had this like lovely man named Giovanni leading me through the dirtiest, filthiest basement you've ever seen.
Oh, boy.
Filled with files of homicides. I had to wear a mask because of the dust. I had to wear gloves because your fingers were black after going through these records. But we found some crazy shit in there.
Oh my gosh. My God. Okay.
This is going to be so fun.
But I do want to tell you, because you two will really appreciate this.
Yeah.
We found a lot of crazy stuff about my family, but my favorite thing about going through the old mafia records from the turn of the century, and it's like mafia bandits, it's really just criminal associations. It's not like the mafia like we think about it today.
Mm.
The biggest crime that people were committing at the early 20th century is the stealing of livestock, the stealing of mules. because how else would you get around these villages? And so transportation is so important.
Yeah.
And there's entire folios of defense arguments against whether or not someone stole a mule. And my favorite line in all of it was, many mules look alike.
Wow.
And I'm like, mind blown. This was a huge
claim ignorance.
Huge trial. And he's like, you know, you can't prove it because many mules look alike.
That is so good. That is like a Sicilian Inheritance Legally Blonde moment. You're like,
it really was. I'm just like in there. I'm like, many mules do look alike.
Oh, you know, the defense lawyer in me is going to, I'm going to work that into my next brief, Joe. You just gave me,
I'm going to send you, I scanned the whole thing and the font on it is so good. I don't know if Mario Puzo, who wrote the book, The Godfather, saw these records or saw similar records, because the font is the Godfather font.
Yes.
Like, isn't that crazy?
Yes.
It's, I mean, it's as if it was like created in central casting for my podcast.
Yeah. I love this. This is going to be so
perfect.
Good.
It's perfect. Yeah. All right. So let's talk about Sarah, as you mentioned, the modern day woman who's going back to solve this crime. And when we meet her, she is really at a breaking point, which makes sense plot wise because we need her to just leave her entire life. And she's in financial trouble. Her marriage has fallen apart. Her career is completely in shambles. But early on, she thinks, in the end, I had wanted too much. I wanted success and love, a career and a child, a marriage and freedom. I'd wanted it all, and I'd ended up with nothing. Mm-hmm. I think that is so relatable to anyone, even if you haven't lost everything the way Sarah has, which is important for this journey.
Mm-hmm.
But it's such a high wire act. We do want all of those things. And even if you're kind of successfully, I'm putting that in air quotes, doing it, you're investing in your career, you're caring for your relationship and your children and investing in your marriage. It's a lot to manage. And it feels so precarious to anyone, even if you haven't. So tell us about Sarah, how you had her start within that, and then her journey.
I love that you pulled that quote, mostly because I'm supposed to pull a bunch of quotes for Instagram content, and I'm tired, and I forgot which ones I wanted to pull. So I want that one. Can you just mail me that after we get off the podcast?
That's great. Tell you what page it's on.
Yeah, that's exactly what I need. You know, when I set out to write this book, I wanted to write an adventure. I wanted to write a murder mystery. And because I am who I am, it also ends up being about, what does it take to be a woman in the world? What does it take to be a woman with ambition in the world, both today and 100 years ago? And frankly, not a whole lot has changed. And so I wanted to think about this concept of how hard it is to, quote unquote, have it all, to want the job, to want the happy marriage, to want to be a mother. And Sarah is both a butcher and a chef, and she's a chef who gets a restaurant in Philadelphia, which is a big deal. You know, women chefs, it is so hard to be both a chef and a mother and to juggle those things. And women chefs are treated very badly, but by the public and the industry oftentimes. Yeah. And, you know, Sarah is a huge success, and then people kind of delight in tearing her down. And her husband, who is great and supportive until he's not, because he wants a wife who is going to be home and taking care of their daughter. And she has a young daughter, and she's struggling to be the best mom she can be. But it feels impossible when you're trying to build a restaurant and also be a mom. And so I didn't want to do the classic trope of drunk woman at breaking point.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Like, I think we see that too often in books and thrillers. It's like, she's an unreliable narrator because she's an alcoholic.
Yeah.
Or she's an unreliable narrator because she's mentally ill. And I'm like, no, she is at a breaking point because being a woman in the world is hard.
Yeah. And because we're all practically there, even if we don't go over the edge.
Because we are all practically there, even if we don't go over the edge. And so I wanted to have Sarah be very relatable to all of us who are juggling all of the things. Right. And we are exhausted. And she leaves her life behind to go to Sicily to try to solve this murder and also see if she can inherit some of this family land to get money to rebuild her life. But she's also at a point where she she really deserves a much needed break.
I was going to say, she's like following the love too. Rosie loved her so much.
And Rosie loved her so much. That is what is pulling
her even more than the mystery.
It really is. It really is. And, you know, I did want to flip a lot of the typical tropes on their heads that we see in female-based thrillers. Again, you know, the woman that is either mentally ill or drinks too much. And then also, and I'm not, I don't want to spoil anything, but I did want to flip around the trope of that we're a little obsessed with dead women. And you know, you'll see how I played with that later on. But we love to tell stories about dead women, and we don't tell nearly as many stories about how they actually lived. And so, so much of this book is how did Serafina live, the woman in the past timeline, and how she channeled her own ambition to become her own woman. And the death is just a little part of it.
Yeah, you're leading so nicely into my next question about Serafina.
I know you do.
So Serafina, her point of view chapters are set in Sicily in the early 1900s. Sarah and her entire family has been told a story about her, the matriarch. So I want to read another passage. Maybe you can use this as a quote. This is so good. You write, there are stories we tell about women. The same stories get retold over and over with different characters in different times, but all containing striking similarities. The story I knew about my family's matriarch was a story of a saint, a martyr, a mother, a wife. A stock character, really. A duty-bound woman who waited patiently for her wandering husband. How many of these kinds of women populate history books and great novels? A sexless being, free of passion. She was a vessel of purity who bore and raised strong children. For generations, we passed down the parts of her that the storytellers found appealing. But none of that was true. All of it was true, but it was only part of her story. So good.
So
you were just alluding to that.
So good.
And guys, I'm going to cry.
Yeah, so good.
Right? I mean, it's so good. And this, and then there's the story, of course, that the men tell about Serafina, that she was a witch and a whore. So you're telling, as you were just referencing, like her whole story. It's a way to reclaim her narrative and that of so many women. So talk to us more about these narratives around women's stories and what you were hoping to challenge or explore.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think that women are often painted as stock characters in history. And my own great-great-grandmother was certainly painted that way. You know, she's the dutiful wife who stayed behind in Sicily. Or, as the other telling goes, she was a quote-unquote witch and a healer and perhaps deserved to die. You know, she's either perfectly good or perfectly evil. And we don't allow women to exist in the in-between. We don't allow women to have complicated, full lives. And I wanted to challenge that notion. I wanted to paint a woman who is not just one thing. And, you know, we see that so often in historical fiction too. And this is a case of who has been telling the stories for so long. You know, we're only just seeing, historical fiction is such a popular genre, but we're only just seeing women take it on. And it seems like it's all women, but this is only in the past about two decades that women have been telling women's stories. And so I think it's so important for us to remember who originally wrote history, which stories are written down and therefore often passed down, and, you know, what that point of view is. That I wanted Serafina, she's much younger than my great-great-grandmother was in real life. Again, this is why I want to write fiction. I'm like, I want to like create these characters. She's only 14 when she gets pregnant and accidentally immediately has to get married, become a mother. She's ambitious. She wants to go to school. She wants to do more, and she can't. And so she's relegated to this role of wife and mother. But when her husband goes to America to try to make a better life for the family, she gets to be more. She gets to take on a job. She doesn't just have to be a mother. She breaks out of the chains of this role. And a lot of the women in the town do. And this is also something that really happened in Sicily. When I first started researching this time period, when, I mean, more than a million Sicilian men left Sicily for America.
Wow.
Some villages were comprised entirely of women, except for the young men, the old men, and the priests. And the women got to take on the men's jobs. The women dealt with all the money. The women bought the land. The women did their actual jobs of shoeing horses, of being butchers. And they got power and control in their lives for the first time. So it's really a special slice of feminist history in Sicily. Yeah. And I wanted to show that, as well as Serafina's journey of going from a very young mother with no options to really discovering herself and coming alive in her 20s and early 30s.
Yeah. She really does. I loved Serafina's chapters. And it can be hard when you're doing a dual point of view and different timelines. And I was so engaged by both stories, by both storylines. And I think a huge part of that for me was how clear and distinct Serafina's voice was. I felt like I was, I don't know, like it was the voiceover moment on a show. And you're like, oh, what's going to happen now? Tell me everything. Your word choice for her was impeccable. Stark contrast to the way we speak and right now, the words we would use. So tell me about when you knew you had to write from Serafina's point of view, in addition to Sarah's, because you could have just done it through Sarah, and how you found her voice. Because again, that was just so striking to me, how different it felt and how I felt like I was being transported in a way just from her voice.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I want to say, even before I say that, you know, I love audiobooks. I'm a big audiobook junkie, and I got to listen to different audition tapes. I was pickiest about Serafina, and some of the tapes that I listened to had this very caricature of an Italian accent. I did not want that. I didn't want an Italian accent full stop. We needed some kind of accent. So we ended up settling on a native Italian speaker, but without like a heavy Italian accent, more of a kind of pan-European accent. But it was really important to me to nail Serafina because she also starts out as 14 and goes into her 80s. To capture her voice, to capture the time period, because this is also the first time that I'm writing historical fiction.
Yeah.
I read so much from that time. So there are a lot of novels and old documents, really. There's very few novels written by women, but there's some. And I read as much of those as I could to not just find the word choice, but also capture some Sicilian dialect, which is not Italian.
Yeah.
And you learn that when you go to Sicily to try to report on a murder and start interviewing the oldest people in town who only speak Sicilian, which was my entire last week. Sicily has been conquered by probably more cultures than almost any place in the world. So Sicilian dialect is really a mix of various Arabic words, of different Northern African words, a little bit of French thrown in there for good measure.
Yeah, sure.
Northern Italians can't understand a bit of it. And in fact, we had a copy editor who was from close to Rome, or she's an American, but she's living close to Rome, which was very, very helpful to have someone that just understood Italy generally. But there were Sicilian words that she was like, this does not exist. And I was like, it does there.
Yeah.
And I also really wanted to get in the head of a 14-year-old girl, who has to become a grown-up. I think that is just such a terrifying choice. I will say that, you know, this book has had a path to publication. I started working on it right after I finished Charlotte Walsh Likes to Win, which is so long ago, seven, 8 years ago. And my editor had left Simon & Schuster, as we all know, because she became my co-writer of my next books. And when your editor leaves a publishing house, you're kind of orphaned. And so, you know, my next book with that house got orphaned, and this one got orphaned, and I was playing around with the idea, but it wasn't there. It just, like, I had the nugget of a story. I didn't have Serafina yet. I just had Sarah. I didn't have Aunt Rosie yet. And I thought it was done. I thought it was totally done. I put it in a box, and I was like, whatever. I'm going to go write these two novels with Christine Pride, and this is never going to be written. And then during the pandemic, I mentioned it to my husband, and he was like, you know, he's like, just write it for you. Write the whole thing. And like, don't, because I've been selling books on partials and then I write them very quickly for publishing houses. He's like, just write it for you and see what happens. Mm. And I haven't done that because I've been, you know, so gung-ho. I'm like, I'm a full-time author. I have to do all the things very, very quickly. And I did. And once I kind of let everything go, that's when Serafina came to me. And that's when Sarah's storyline and Aunt Rosie and the characters really came. And also Juicy, who is in the present day. And she is my favorite character of all time. Yeah. She is just so a badass. You hate her. You love her. She's so many things. Mm-hmm. She disappeared. She just appeared in my head and was like, you will write me now.
Oh, that's amazing.
I know. Love and then she gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And then my agents loved the book. I finished it. They loved it. So many publishing houses said, but Joe doesn't write historical fiction or thrillers. How do we sell this? And I'm like, you sell it as a book.
Yeah.
But they fucking love a swim lane, right? They're like, we want authors to do the same thing over and over and over again. And I'm like, I'm sorry, I don't. Yeah. And so that was a challenge. It was a challenge. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the book did go to auction and then it got preempted. But for a while there, I was like, oh, my gosh, maybe no one wants this.
Right. But once they saw past that, they were like, this is a really good book.
Yes. Yeah. But I don't think that some of the ones that couldn't see past it didn't even look past it. Right. Yeah, they didn't even read it because they're like, this is not what Joe Piazza writes. She writes contemporary women's fiction. So we won't even look at it. And I'm like, well, that's the problem with all of you with publishing. So that was a roller coaster. And then Maya Ziv at Dutton. She actually read it on her honeymoon in Italy.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. Crazy, right? Yeah. And fell in love with it. And she got it. She just freaking got it. But I like to tell that story because even though I've published 12 books, even though the last one was a Good Morning America book club pick, it sold hundreds of thousands of copies, I still had a huge challenge selling the Sicilian Inheritance. It was not easy because it's different from the things I've ever written. And I don't think men are pigeonholed in that way. John Grisham and James Patterson are allowed to write whatever the fuck they want.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. That's right.
Oh,
incredible.
Boy.
Well, I'm glad they took, let you out of your swim lane and
I still don't know if they're happy about it.
Well,
we are.
Listen, we are. So I want to talk about a theme that I loved in this, which is what I call women helping women. Both of these women, Serafina and Sarah, have desires and ambitions, like many of the female characters in the book. Mm-hmm. But they, of course, both, even in their different generations, face obstacles and the patriarchy and everything else that rubs up against those desires. But what they have in common is that they both realize the power of other women to work with them, to help them. Mm-hmm. And I love you have this women's studies professor as a character, and she tells Sarah about this goddess named Astarte. I'm probably
Astarte.
Saying Astarte. Astarte. I was going to do it, but I thought I'd be putting on a fake accent. But no,
it's okay. I'm allowed to put on the fake accent. I'm allowed to like murder all of these words. Astarte.
Astarte. And she describes this to Sarah, and she says it's more way of life, a spirit, a story we pass down, a way of reminding ourselves that the only way for a woman to survive in this world is to help other women. That should also be a quote.
You're going to send me all of these. You're doing my job for me. I was literally going to spend the whole morning going back through the book. And so like you did it. Perfect.
I love
Thank
quotes.
You. Yeah, I know, me too.
But it just feels so incredibly true to me in life, in the only way I know how. So tell us about this theme for you.
It's true. And, you know, it's another trope that I wanted to flip on its head, because I do think in a lot of these novels, we see women being very unkind to each other. We don't see women banding together to help one another. We see a lot of jealousy and vicious ambition. I mean, particularly in the whole genre of women's fiction that I came up with, you know, from the 90s and early 2000s, things like The Devil Wears Prada, which when I look back at it, I was like, she's not a bitch. She's just the boss and she's doing her freaking job, girl.
Yes.
And so I wanted to have a story where women are genuinely helping other women, where we are overcoming the odds that are stacked against us by making sure to put out a helping hand. And I think that that is, it's a message that I try to pass down to younger writers as well, because when I was coming up in media, women were also pitted against each other. It's like, you know, there's so few of you that you are competing with the other women in this room. And that is not true. You know, the tide rises all the ships. And the only way that we can create change in this world and in our individual lives is by women banding together and helping one another. And we see that in Serafina's life, and then we see that in Sarah's life in the modern day. And it was a really important theme for me to weave throughout the entire story, because my female friends have been the backbone of my whole life. Yeah. I love my husband. He's great. He's not my best friend. He's my husband. He does the husband things. He's father of my children. But mm-hmm. it's the women that have really lifted me up and let me be all of the things. And, yeah. you know, let me be a writer and a mother and a wife and all of the things in the world that I'm still failing at every day, but let me try.
Yeah. You know, yeah. sometimes it feels like we are working against the narratives that like that are ingrained in us. But this women helping women just feels like clarifying the narrative we've all already felt.
Yes.
Like we're like, yes. it wasn't like that. Why are you saying that that's all this is?
It wasn't right. yeah. like that. Exactly. Yeah. Like in real life, you know, so many books also focus on romance. Between a man and a woman. And I wanted this. I mean, look, there's some steamy sex scenes, which I'm very excited about. I just finished an essay for Cup of Joe about how do you write steamy sex scenes when in real life you like vanilla missionary sex.
That's so good. You gotta yeah. read that.
Oh, it'll be out in like a week. I finished it yesterday and just turned it in. Perfect. And it's true. I'm like, you know, just my current kink is efficiency. But the, you know, the backbone, like I said, of my own life is other women. And I don't think we see the love relationships yeah. between women enough in books. And mm-hmm. those friendships that are just so important.
Yeah. 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 I also want to talk about motherhood, because yeah, there are please. So many yeah. portraits of motherhood in this novel. So many different feelings, the deep desire for it, the ambivalence, the... you know, I want it, but am I doing it right? Questioning mm-hmm. of it. And you've already just mentioned, and in your acknowledgments, you talk about writing this book when you first found out you were going to become a mother. Mm-hmm. And you said that something about that massive sea change in my identity made this story call to me. I love that. I often talk about the way I felt my whole DNA rearranged when I became a mother, and how it was overwhelming in the good and the bad ways, mm-hmm. But just a sea change of in my identity. I love that. So talk about why you wanted to give us these different portraits of motherhood and how and what that massive sea change was like for you.
Oh my gosh, I'm a whole different person. Like yeah. I think my entire DNA changed when I became a mother 7 years ago, and I've been breeding ever since. Like, it has been nonstop. I have a 6-year-old, a 4-year-old, and a 1-year-old right now. So yeah. I've either been pregnant or nursing for 7 years.
Yeah.
And that's a lot. And I'm a whole new person on the other side of this. You know, someone emailed me questions for an interview a couple days ago and said, hey, how do you handle motherhood and being a writer? I know a lot of female authors don't like this question because men don't get asked it. And I love this question because I want to talk about it. I don't care that men don't get asked it. Maybe it's sexist, but who gives an F? Because I think young women need to know how we do all the things, and they want to hear mm-hmm. how I balance it. And young women come up to me at events and say, thanks for being a mom and also being an author and showing me that I can mm-hmm. do those things. I also did an interview yesterday where the woman was like, I've been putting off the IUI because I didn't think I could juggle being ambitious and being a mom. And you made me decide to make the appointment for next week. And I'm like, yeah, freaking do yeah. it, man. Yes. Freaking do it.
That's great.
I know, yeah. right? So I'm like, I want to be asked about it. And no, my husband's never going to be asked about it. And I don't care because he doesn't know how to do half this stuff. I wanted to show different kinds of motherhood, different reactions to motherhood, because also for so long, we've seen one kind of mother. We see the mother yeah. who is just... when the idea that when you get pregnant and you have that baby, you immediately love it to death, or not even love it. I love my kids. I didn't like them at first. I didn't know what to do. I felt incapable, right?
Yes.
We also see mothers that just, they want it, they want it, they want it, or they're ambivalent. But once they get pregnant, once they have that baby, they love it, they love it, they want it.
It's, yeah.
it's all erased. All of the ambivalence, all of the gray areas are erased. And I wanted to show so many different kinds of mothers, the kind of mother who doesn't necessarily want it, but's going to work hard at it anyway. You know, the kind of mother that really, really wants it. And then drop some of the balls to try to be ambitious in other ways. And because we don't see enough different kinds of motherhood in media, pop culture, and especially fiction, I think that's what lends to so much mom guilt and shame, because we think we're supposed to be this one kind of mother, and there's no one kind of mother. Again, I don't like being pregnant. I don't like newborns. Now that my daughter is 1 year old, I'm like, you're fucking awesome.
Yeah.
But like during the baby phase nearly killed me, and it nearly killed me every time. I don't like
it. I loved what you wrote on your newsletter about that, that you had me at I don't like babies. I'm like, exactly.
Yeah.
I don't like
other people's babies, my own babies. No.
I don't want to see a baby. I had a friend have a baby last week and they just sent me pictures. I'm like, that's gross. Look at that squiggly little alien. I'm like, oh, I don't want to hold that baby.
Yeah.
I mean, good for you. Happy for you. I don't want a baby.
Call me in a year.
I wanted to show all of that because I just came home, like I said, from Sicily on Sunday night, and Eliza, my baby, is one and change. And I'm like, you're so awesome right now. She just like sits up on her own. She said, mommy, she feeds herself. I can leave and go to the bathroom. Yes.
Yeah.
Like there's freedom in that. And there's like a genre of Instagram reels of like set over really cheesy, lame wedding songs from the 90s where they're like, you're gonna miss this time. You're gonna miss it. And I'm like, no, I'm not. Maybe I'll look back fondly at it and I'll like it, but I'll also like the next stage. So stop guilting me about this. Like I also miss my 20s and dancing on bars, but I don't want to be that person again.
Exactly. Yeah. And by the way, I don't miss it. I do now romanticize like it went fast. But it didn't. Yeah. It didn't.
It's long so long.
And painful and terrible.
It's
but
so that is, long.
But I never look back and go, oh, I miss that. Oh, no. No, no, no.
No, no, no. No. Like, allow us the room to grow, right? Because by, like, those narratives are like, you're only, like, useful and wonderful as a mother when your kids are little and you're mothering them so freaking hard. I took both the big kids to school today because Nick is in New York and we bike them an electric cargo bike because my husband is trying to save the planet. And so we do that.
Oh, my God.
And my oldest is only in first grade. And I'm like, oh, my God, I'm going to be taking a child to kindergarten until I'm 50.
Oh, gosh. You did the math.
I did the math. And I'm like, oh,
dangerous. God,
it was really dangerous. Really dangerous.
Oh, my God.
Well, I want to ask you a different question about balancing. I want to ask you how you balance the work of being a writer, which is writing, with the work of being an author, because you are so good at promotion and content creation. I would love to, but I feel like, well, besides the fact that I'm so awkward, it takes a lot of time.
It's so much time of work.
How do you balance those things? Because you're also a prolific writer, so it's not like you're sacrificing one or the other.
Yeah. Writing is very, very easy for me. It comes very naturally. I could write books constantly, right?
Oh, wow.
It is the marketing and publicity that is not natural for me that I've had to teach myself to do. And unfortunately, I have to do it because reaching readers is harder than ever. And you have to be a content machine and a content master. And it still might not work. That's the thing.
Like,
it still might not work. You know, we're at a publishing space that I think is very interesting where everyone kind of like hopes and prays you get one of the three celebrity book clubs. And when that doesn't happen, there's like no other marketing plan except you do it yourself. And I can say that because I've been on all of the sides of this, right? And that's not good for books because, you know, you want readers to find the book that speaks to them. So I've trained myself to be good at social media because I've also reported on social media. My podcast, Under the Influence, is about social media. And honestly, it's just like, I watch what works and then I try to do it. Yeah. But that is the part that drains me. That is what exhausts me. My best friend who I was in Italy with was like, why don't you ever comment on my Instagram feed? And I'm like, because Instagram is work. I don't look at it the way that, you know, you
other do.
If this isn't your job, I go on, I post, I like answer messages because it is also my inbox, like my email in a lot of ways. And then I have to get back off of it. Otherwise, it will like suck up all of my time. and my life. So I don't see my friends on Instagram. It's not, I don't see a feed in the same way.
Yeah.
And that's like really to protect my mental health because I get so completely exhausted by it. But then I also love it because I've reached so many new readers through doing that. I like the Substack the best because I can write long form.
Yeah.
I kind of balance it with, like I said, I can write really fast and I can write well fast because I was a newspaper reporter
for
so long.
I was going to say.
I was a gossip reporter. So it was like when newspapers were newspapers and not a website. So it's like you need to write by 5 o'clock at night or you're fired. And so I can write so fast. And I do that first thing in the morning when I'm really fresh too, because social media and the internet fry my brain. And so by the afternoon, I can't write anything. And I make myself, if I'm working on a novel, I make myself write 2,000 words in the morning, every single morning. If I'm working on publicity for it, I make myself write whatever essays I'm doing. Like I said, I just finished that Cup of Joe essay about liking vanilla sex. I just wrote something for People magazine about investigating this real life murder. I can only do that first thing when I wake up. And then the rest of the day, I'm like, all right, you can make content. Yeah. But the world is very, very different than when I published my first novel.
Right? Yeah.
It's crazy. But, it's crazy. And I think, you know, readers also don't want to hear writers complain.
Yes. And they want access to you. It's not just about sales of your book. It's not like I did a reel and I will sell 5 books. It's about the readers wanting access to you and expecting access to you as part of the package of the book.
As part of the package of the book. Exactly. And for this one, I'm doing all, it's such a multimedia platform, right? So we've got the novel, The Sicilian Inheritance, then the true crime podcast, The Sicilian Inheritance. And I'm going to blow your freaking mind right here. We're also selling a Sicilian olive oil called The Sicilian Inheritance.
Oh my God, I love that. No, we are.
there's a school mom here in Philly, my friend Larissa, and she owns an artisanal olive oil shop. And we have created an entire Sicilian Inheritance olive oil that we will also be selling alongside all of these things. So like we are a full multimedia shop.
What about though? I don't need to give you ideas, but I know you love to travel.
Yes.
So is there going to be like a travel tour with this?
Yes, there is. You gotta have the tour of Sicily. So we will also be doing the Sicilian Inheritance trip in October. The first week of it will be a writer's retreat, and the second week of it will be a reader's trip through Sicily.
Oh wow!
So yes. And that's perfect. I'm gonna put the application up soon. We just want to gauge interest, really. It'll be, I think we'll be based in the town of Scapello because it's easy to get to from the Palermo airport, and then take day trips to different places all over the island. You can make it to the East Coast and the West Coast. And I also want to make it as cheap as possible for people. So I'm like, all right, guys, buy this book so that I can get people to freaking sponsor this so I can bring everyone to Sicily for free, okay?
Right. Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah, I love it.
I've become a multimedia brand of the Sicilian Inheritance over here.
You are a woman. You are my idol.
What is you, marketing monster or something? I don't know. I think it's amazing.
I'm a marketing monster. And it's my friend Nora McInerney, who does the Terrible Thanks for Asking podcast and is a brilliant best-selling author, was like, don't call yourself a marketing monster. Like, a man would never say that. And I'm like, but I kind of am. And I was worried that my audience would hate it, but they don't, because life is so crazy. People want to be reminded of things. So people send me all their receipts for the Sicilian Inheritance, and then I add them to the newsletter for free because books are expensive. And I feel like people deserve something when they buy the book, and I appreciate them. And I get to talk to everyone when they do that too. But everyone has been like, oh, thanks, I meant to do it, and then I forgot. Yes.
Oh, right? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I need 5 reminders.
Yeah, I think a lot of people need like 20 reminders. Yes. It used to be that you'd see a book 7 times, and now I think you need to see it 37 times.
I was going
to
say, I need 5 reminders, and it's my job.
And it's your job.
Yeah. So if it's something just for me, I do need 27 reminders.
Same. Right? Yeah. So, exactly. So I don't even feel like a monster anymore. I'm like, this is just, I'm telling everyone, make sure to get your orders in. It's now, it will show up when you order it right now. Right. And because I want this book to reach as many readers as possible.
It helps that you're entertaining as hell. So that is great.
Thank you.
Do we want to wrap this one up with the lightning round? We have some questions that we want to ask about.
Do it. I love it when you do a lightning round.
Okay, good.
Done.
Good.
Okay. All right. Favorite book as a child?
Judy Blume's Freckle Juice.
Oh, good one. I know. How do you read? Paper, e-reader, and audio. You've already said you're a big audio junkie.
I'm a big audio junkie. Yeah. But I do a lot of nonfiction in audio because I like it when the author reads and that feels like consuming podcasts. I'm much pickier about fiction. But I read books. I can't e-read because I'm on screen so often that feels like too much work. And I hate to say this, but I prefer a paperback. Hardcovers are so unwieldy. I begged for Sicilian Inheritance to be a paperback when it came out. But, you know, again, people are like, oh, no, it'll seem like a lesser book or something. And I'm like, readers just want a paperback. They just want it. But so I'm appreciative of everyone that buys this hardcover because I know they're expensive and they're big. It's hard to take it on vacation. And I want you to take it on vacation.
That's right. All right, do you write to music or ambient noise?
Dead silence.
Dead silence.
Yeah, I have to have dead silence.
I need dead silence. Mm-hmm.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I can write anywhere. I can. Like, I mean, if I'm in a coffee shop, because I was a reporter on Deadline for so long, I'll just sit down and write anywhere. I'm not precious.
Yeah. Right. Okay. All right. Planning, drafting, revising. Which takes the most time for you and which is your favorite?
Revising takes the most time. I don't plan at all. I just did an event with the author El Casamano, who writes the Finley Donovan series. Yeah. And she introduced me to a new word that I love. She's like, are you a planner or a pantser? And I'm like, what's a pantser? And she's like, someone who flies by the seat of their pants. When I'm writing alone, I fly by the seat of my pants. I sit down. I don't outline. I don't plot. I just like see what happens every day. And that's part of the magic of it. So that doesn't take me as long as revising, as then going back and being like, does any of this make any sense? So my longest is the revising. I enjoy the drafting the most, though. I enjoy just sitting down and pantsing and letting the characters talk to you, because it's true. Like, part of writing 2,000 words every day is that then they talk to you for the rest of the day. And I make notes. I email myself notes all day long. Like the subject line for this one was Sicilian.
So you just email yourself.
I email myself all day.
Instead of keeping like a document or notes, you
I email myself and then I open that when I need to write in the morning. And I already have usually like 500 words that are ready to go.
That's great.
Yeah. Right. Because you've done that.
You're off and running. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, what are you loving right now? I mean, reading, watching, listening to, tell us.
Yes. So I have hardly had any time to watch the TVs lately.
The TVs.
There hasn't been much on it.
The TVs. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. But I did just take a 10-hour flight. And so I got to catch up on season 3 of the other two. And I think it's the best season of that show yet. It is so irreverent that it just makes me so happy after the past 4 years of cancel culture. I'm like, you're just like taking the piss out of everything. And I was laughing out loud on this plane while people were trying to sleep. And I love it so much. I also love the Apple TV show Platonic with Rose Byrne and Seth Rogen about two platonic friends from college who are both going through midlife crises, because it's just fun and delicious and like a romp. Oh. My favorite book of the past year, and I say this all the time, was The Secret Book of Flora Lee. By Patty Henry. It was just so magical and so different. And I love Patty, and her Friends in Fiction podcast is my favorite book podcast and one that I listen to a lot, like a lot. And then, you know, I mentioned my friend Nora McInerney. She has produced a new podcast called The Silver Chain. It's a narrative podcast, and it's about swingers in the 70s. They found this, like, all of these documents in the Minnesota Historical Society vault about this Minnesota secret swinger society. And the podcast is investigating, like, what it was and where the people are now. And it's so good and juicy. And I got an early listen to it, so I binged that entire thing.
Oh, fun. Nice. Oh, God.
Swingers in Minnesota. Yeah.
That is fascinating. Fascinating. Joe, thank you so much for joining us again. The Sicilian Inheritance, as I said, it made me cry.
Good. I'm so happy that I made you cry.
Oh, yes. I mean, Serafina, she really got to me. Yeah. And I'm not a historical fiction fan.
That's the thing. I think this book will appeal to both historical fictions and non-historical fiction fans.
I agree.
Absolutely.
I agree. Yeah. Because of the humanity.
I tend to have trouble with dual timelines for the reasons. Well, because I tend to like one more than the other. It's just
everyone
just
does.
True.
Everyone does.
But,
yes.
But I did. I loved them both. I genuinely loved them both.
Yes. That makes me so happy.
Masterclass.
Well done.
And just so much fun. Like you said, so much joy.
So much joy. Just joy. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. All the joy. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For coming back and keep coming. Keep coming.
Yes. I'm just here now. I live with you.